Welcome to Season 2 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istral and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we're going to start with our usual introduction and news, followed by a chat with Jakob Pultman about the new 1.0 FAQ, after which we're going to bring on Dave from Germany to talk about the structure and format of tournaments, and then we're going to give you our tip of the week, and finally, just before we give you our usual closing comments, some spoilers for the second edition first chapter pack. All right, it's episode 37, John.
Hooray!
Is 37 good?
37's awesome. It's my age.
Really? I thought you were ages older than that. I thought you were like 38. Good lord.
Ages.
Well, there's a fair bit of news this week, not the least of which is the new FAQ, but for first edition. We'll be talking about that in its own segment. But we actually have a couple of tournament results so far.
I heard there were some 2.0 tournaments going down.
There are some 2.0 tournaments. I don't really have any results, but there's Thronestoberfest, which still had some 1.0 goodness.
Using the new FAQ, and Dave Stroms crushed that event, not losing a single match with Paw Patrol.
Paw Patrol. Now, our listeners may not be familiar with Paw Patrol. What is Paw Patrol?
Paw Patrol is a Stark Conquest to Lannister build, using all that dire wolf goodness to make a giant tower and kill everything.
It's fun. It's a little pet. I mean, it's a pet deck of yours, really.
Well, yeah. A pet deck of mine and Dave. We both worked a lot on it. And I think we're actually going to have Dave on next week to talk about it. So
that's the plan, yes. And the other big tournament that was going on that we announced last week is the Tournoi de la Main, which is actually currently ongoing. We're recording a day earlier because John gets to go to Vegas. Vegas, baby, right? Yes?
Yeah. Yay.
Sound excited. So John gets to go to Vegas, and so we don't have the results of that, but the top 16 is posted on AGOT cards already at the time of recording today on Saturday, and I assume will be played out on Sunday, so I'm sure we'll have some interesting results out of that. Tournament news in general. So there's two sorts of things. In addition to the new FAQ, there's a brand new set of draft rules.
Which is awesome.
Worlds. So they're describing
really good.
How they're going to do the draft. So maybe walk us through that?
Yeah, like I remember the rules. The cool part is you get to redraft several times in the tournament, which is actually really important for a true draft experience. Because once you leave that little pod you're in, you should almost always have to redraft. Because there's a skill actually in drafting itself. So, you know, having a bunch of weak people with that, weaken that skill set with a very strong person lets them build a much stronger deck. So it wouldn't be fair if they progress with that stronger deck. And FFG has realized that, and they're making redrafting mandatory.
What I thought was interesting, actually, was the fact that they were going to use both draft sets. I mean, obviously, they're probably just trying to offload product that's never going to move ever again, and it's entirely selfish reasons. But I think that's a fun way to go through it, even though the second draft was a much stronger draft set. You know, everyone's playing in a level field in a draft. So yep. So give some variety, give some differences there, and three redraftings before you win your tournament, and it's separate prize support for the draft. I think that's excellent.
Yeah, and actually I thought it was awesome that they were using the two different draft packs as well, because it takes a much higher level of skill to understand the important cards in each grouping. So I think that will actually give an advantage to the more skilled drafters. You put in the time practicing, it'll pay off.
There was another piece of news, which was they posted the tournament kits for the, what are they called, the game night kits?
Yep.
For the upcoming second edition stuff. There will be no more game night kits for first edition, no surprise to us. So these are a really nice old bear playmat, it's nice to have a nice old bear playmat because the card isn't very good. Nice old bear boxes, again, great to put your other good Night's Watch cards in.
And what's the alternate art card?
Yeah, that I'm not too impressed with. So the alternate art card, the common one, It looks really good. It's fortified position. I really like that plot. I do think it's odd to make that the more accessible one, given that it's a limit one per plot deck.
Yes, exactly. And who's going to want like two or three of them?
They did the same thing. I mean, at Gen Con, they gave out the Game of Thrones plot, which is a fantastic plot. I think it's a good choice. The art is nice. But again, it's a limit one per plot deck, and I would much rather they push those as the sort of rarer cards, while in this case, the rarer card that they push is the Tumblestone Knight, that they have two or three copies of in the kit. And that's a card that you could have three of in your deck and that you could want multiple copies of. So that's... This structure feels a little backwards, yeah. It does mean that I guess I'll probably walk away with a fortified position, and since I don't care much about the Tumblestone Knights, I guess I can't complain.
Yeah. So there's other news. There's a international Facebook group going on for Game of Thrones. I think there's like 500 members so far.
Actually, it's eclipsed us. I think it's over 700 now, and we hit 600 likes just this week, which is great. And then this group started the day we hit 600 likes. They were at 500 likes 2 days later, and they're now over 700. So we're going to have to start plugging some of our stuff on this international Facebook group as well.
But we think it's a great idea. Like,
do we?
If you haven't joined, I do. I think it's awesome. It's a good place to – if I'm going to Vegas, I can shoot at something on that and say, hey, I'm going to Vegas, and someone from Vegas can send me a private message on Facebook or something.
See, I don't necessarily disagree. I'm just not sure what is gained – from that over being in a community like CardGameDB.
Here's the difference. Everyone's on Facebook all the time. They're not always on CardGameDB.
Well, I am. Maybe that's where my loss is. Fair enough.
Yeah.
There was something that I wanted to mention last week, but as the episode was running long, we sort of pushed it over to this week. But we should probably at least mention it. It's big in the LCG world, not necessarily very important for Thrones, but you have doubtless heard about this Conquest controversy about the national champion at Gen Con.
Oh, the guy that created the fake accounts just to make himself sound good?
Oh, see, that's the best part that comes afterwards. But yeah, so this is the national champion at Gen Con was caught on camera cheating.
Cheating in multiple games, multiple times.
That's right, in at least the semifinal and the final game. In the equivalent of the draw phase, because there's lots of other times that cards are drawn in the command phase in Conquest, but in the equivalent of the draw phase, he was basically manipulating it so it was clear he could draw three cards, and if you do the card counts, you can see it. But it was...
Over and over again.
It's good sleight of hand because nobody noticed it at the time, and it really took someone slowing it down to frame by frame practically to notice or to count the cards that were coming out to go, hold on, something's wrong here. But it's pretty incontrovertible. You can't really argue that he thought that you're supposed to draw three cards every draw phase. You know, that's...
Oh, maybe he did. Maybe he was a new player and he just thought three is the number I should draw, and he just did that all tournament.
It's obviously cheating bad, and the community has pounced on him, and he attempted to defend himself in what will now go down in history as probably some of the funniest posts I've ever seen on the internet.
He was nervous, so that's why he drew three cards seven times in a row.
No, but the best part is when he creates the Sock Puppet account and then forgets to log out of the Sock Puppet, posts himself using the Sock Puppet.
And then after writes like a few things, that's
this
from
is
him.
This is from him in the wrong
because
account.
I became a friend of him.
I want t-shirts that say this or that was from him, I think.
That was from him, Conquest t-shirt.
Obviously, it is a shame. I mean, I don't think it means that cheating is more or less prevalent. I don't think it reflects poorly on the Conquest community.
No, they're a great community.
But my suggestion, and I don't know if this will happen, is to take it in stride and laugh at it and do an unofficial championship between the two last people he defeated and force one of them to wear a shirt that says, you know, like unofficial champion, or this is from him.
The other person the card gets a play match.
Yeah. Well, there actually isn't a card design for their national, so that's good as well. But I mean, FFG hasn't stepped forward, and I can kind of they only found this out about 2 weeks ago, and I don't know if it really matters whether they strip the person of their title or not. And
I think they should.
Whether it sets a precedent. Well,
I think if you're caught cheating, you should lose it.
It's hard to do after the fact. I mean, FFG has done disqualifications during tournaments and things like that.
Well, some people are calling for this guy never to play in another major event again, where they take his name and they don't let him play.
I don't mind a one-year ban or something. I don't think a lifetime ban is correct. Not because I endorse the cheating, but because hopefully that would be somewhat sufficient.
But here first, Alex endorses cheating.
I could see also it being banned followed by an automatic warning at every tournament you go to, so that if you're caught doing anything slightly suspicious, you already have a warning with their new system. Sort of zero-tolerance approach. Well, obviously, it should be a zero-tolerance approach from then on. And Throws is not immune to these controversies either. We've caught someone on camera cheating during a game, the famous French shuffle, from a player who was actually
never
a
trust
magician.
The French.
He was a professional magician, and he was caught on camera with completely false shuffles and stacking his decks.
Yeah, that's bad. Yeah, actually, trust the French. They're great people. Just not that guy.
Anyway, if you haven't seen the forum stories, it's worth reading through the first 10 pages at a glance starts defending himself, because it really is very, very funny. Internet comedy gold. Lastly, the only thing that I wanted to go over was something that Aaron has been strongly pushing. Aaron Glazer, who's also one of the co-hosts on the White Book, and he's been circulating this effort and trying to coordinate more metas into sharing decks. And he wound up writing a little thing that he wanted all of these people agreeing to it to read. And I think it's much funnier if I get the dyslexic guy to read this out on the cast. So I'm going to paste this into our Skype window, and you're going to read it, John.
Great. Thanks.
Yeah, right. That was too painful for mortal ears, and I just cut it all. However, we do fully endorse Aaron's push to get people to publish and make public top four deck lists, and we'll be linking his relevant thread. All right, rather than be joined from the giant underwear wielder, from Sweden, we're now being joined all the way from Tel Aviv by the very same giant underwear.
Yes.
So thank you, Jakob, for joining us.
Definitely.
Obviously, the topic today is going to be the FAQ. Not so much the timing. We already agree that it's all late. But this is the FAQ that starts off with the word, that this one is for the fans, says Nate in his article. Do you guys agree with that?
No.
No.
That was the first thing as I read that. No. With the same and the same length of I wasn't quite convinced. So how would you describe this FAQ? If not like point by point, but just what this FAQ does.
I mean, this FAQ is focused on neutering some very specific builds in very specific ways and then throwing control a bone, right?
That's a good way to describe it. What about you, Jakob? How would you describe it?
Well, something along the same lines, but I want to focus a little bit more on actually being sad about that, because I think this FAQ is about nerfing certain decks and opening up to some more, but the nerfing is so hard, and I don't understand why, and that's why I don't really agree with. Yeah, it's like I don't understand why pushing against certain decks so hard would help. And to quote Nate, be for the fans.
To me, it's clear that they said, okay, the stuff that has been winning since the last FAQ, we don't even want to see it in the top 150 decks. You know, it's not, oh, we want to take Dragon Pit and we want to nudge it down so it's back in line, or maybe a little bit below, but some people could still play it. We want to take Maesters, do the same. It's, these are two decks that have been performing well, and we want to make sure that Worlds feels different, which is admirable. But the way we're going to do that is by basically pounding these things into the ground. And it's serious overkill, the way I look at it.
Yeah, but what struck me was that I wanted to think, has there been an FAQ for the last few years that has been nerfing decks so hard? And in a way, have these decks been so dominant that they needed to nerf them so hard?
There have been FAQs that have nerfed decks so hard.
Yes.
Certainly, for instance, we can talk about the House of Pain, that then we had Long Lances and Street Waif and all this other stuff come out, or Knights of the Hollow Hill Bera, where then we had, you know, shortly
Red Queen's Faithful, Desperate Measures.
And the errata to the agenda and so on. So there certainly
and Bloodthirst as well.
Targeted ones. Yeah. And Old
Dragon Pit may have been that good, right? But was the Bera Maesters that good? Like, I tested with it. I didn't think it was that good. I took it to Melee for a reason.
I think Stark Maesters won a lot.
It was better, yes. It was better than the Barrowmaesters, I agree.
Well, they both got hit by this change.
Yeah. Yes, I know. Yeah, absolutely.
But was it necessary?
Yeah, and there were some ridiculous changes, like the King Viss change. Has King Viss, with the attachments, ever won anything?
Was it? Didn't Dennis Harrison run it in Gen Con?
He did.
But so did others.
Yeah, that was a deck that Alex Trigg had brought up, obviously. It's a sort of thing he might. And he had talked to me about, and I built it, and I managed to improve it a little bit. And I said, man, this thing could win, but there's no way I'm going to play it. And I made the mistake of mentioning it as a sort of control deck to John. And then John handed it to basically Dennis and Sandy to play. And the thing is, that deck certainly can win on turn two. It auto-loses to Rule by Decree, or almost auto-loses. There are some ways it can play around it. If you know what the deck is doing, you'll beat it. It's not going to win a tournament. Sure, it can be a negative experience to play against, but is that what you're worried about at Worlds at your last tournament? Of saying, oh, well, I happen to play against an uninteractive deck at the highest level of the last tournament.
That one time out of the five, and it beat me, and if it beat you, here's something. Yeah. You deserve to lose. Okay?
So
every deck has answers to King Viss.
Almost. That said, I don't care about this change. I think the meta is probably fine. A better place without it. That's fine.
It's just a useless change.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's more when it comes to the restricted list that I have questions.
The second change in the errata also to me feels unnecessary. No.
Oh, no? Oh, I think it's needed.
There has always been a Barrack deck, especially in the European field, that makes somewhere in the top 8 or top 16. And yet, we haven't seen this deck dominate ever.
It won a Chinese National.
Yeah, I think that was a year and a half ago.
Yeah, a year and a half ago.
Yeah, the
we're obviously talking about the Barrack deck, right?
Yes, about various forms of the Barrack deck. Now, again, there was one in Sweden that did very well. There was one at Stalag that did very well.
There has been Barrack decks every year in Stalag for the last 3 or 4 years that have made at least top 8.
And they do fine, but they're still not destroying the meta. They're not that common. They're not.
The thing is, there's been some new tools added for those types of decks, and it's not just Barrack. It's you saw some other people coming in with out of Stark doing tower decks. We see the Viper as a restricted tower deck still, like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Viper style. And I think with some of the new search abilities specifically in Tark to find the Veil and the tasks that let you find the Veil and stuff, it makes it just easier to do that. And this might have been a preventative measure because we might have hit something close to a critical mass, and FFG might have been doing some testing. Maybe they got some playtesters, and they said, oh, we can do this tower now. We better stop this before Worlds, or it just won't be fun.
I think you're hitting something that we're seeing here. They're definitely nerfing the tower decks with the restricted list as well, and with this. And I'm not really sure I agree that the Snakeskin's Veil was really the problem here, because you're right, John, that there are things that have come out that make these tower decks much stronger. There has also come cards that definitely go against these decks.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I mean
Yak, have you tasted a tower deck, right? In a way, that Targan A ended up playing a tower Mad King against you in the final.
Yeah,
I saw it streamed.
Yeah, and a lost message. Slows the deck down or solves the decks or march. I mean, there are answers to all of these decks. But
I built a tower deck before Gen Con. I spent 2 weeks testing one, thinking that it might do well in the meta. I don't believe that would have been the deck to win Gen Con, and I don't believe it would be the deck to win Worlds. I think it would be a deck that you'd probably see one of in the top 16, and I don't see that as something you need to solve.
And another thing is that these decks are not new. I mean, like you said, they've been around for a long time. And especially since this is a swan song of 1.0, why would they nerf a deck that is not, in my opinion at least, such a negative player experience? I mean, you get to interact with a board. It's not like they're playing solitaire. They still need to do their thing, and they still need to stop you from doing your thing.
And they have to win challenges, because when Alex and I think prepping for... That was Worlds last year. We could get Barrack going with Sansnik Veil, whole kit and caboodle, like fully decked out by turn
94% of the time, turn one. Yeah. Yep.
We still couldn't win matches, even with Barrack all set up, because you have to win challenges. And you're standing Barrack and you got all these things going, but a couple Vipers Bannermen on the board, and you're just not pushing through those challenges.
Yeah. So I don't really agree with this errata, even though I kind of understand why they are doing it in the aspect of we want to bring the negative player experience decks down to zero, but there are still decks out there that are much worse than Beric when it comes to negative player experience.
Yeah.
All right, well, we've got the restricted list then.
Let's read it in order.
And discuss them point by point, or just all
point
together?
By point.
All right, first
well,
one.
Sure. Actually, yeah, some of them we have to discuss together. So
right,
I think
so
the
let's
first
start with
two.
Dragon Pit and Threat from the North, then.
Exactly. I mean, they full out neutered the pit decks with this. I think it's going to be extremely hard to have an effective pit without Threat and the pit together.
Yeah.
Well, I think it might still be possible without Threat and the pit together, but without Preston or
Fear of Winter,
Fear of Winter or one of the other tricks, no, I think it's not.
I think putting
Dragon Pit on the restricted list alone or putting Threat on the restricted list alone would have been enough to knock Dragon Pit down out of the bonus
best deck around.
Exactly.
Yeah. I can see from the point that you made in the beginning that FFG and Nate wants to do this, that this type of deck or like Dragon Pit that won and even had the mirror match in Gen Con, that they don't want to see that win world because they want to see something else win. But I think by saying that and just that, you're missing one very important thing, is that this type of deck can bring other types of decks in, like not bring it down, but hold it in motion, like hold it steady where it should be.
Yeah, and without the pressure from Dragon Pit, the meta changes.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's important that Dragon Pit or some kind of Light Burn is going to be in the meta.
It needs to be in the meta, is what you're trying to say. I think you need that to hold down the Lannister and the Martell, because without it, and I think we're going to agree when we start going through this restricted list, they're going to just become too powerful.
Mm.
I think they could have – I mean, we mentioned this when we were talking about the sort of before 2-3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. I think it was 2 weeks ago. And I was thinking Threat from the North, and you were thinking Dragon Pit. And you eventually convinced me that that was the better restricted choice so long as something was added for the Maesters. And
I suggested Lead Link.
No, you suggested Valyrian Steel Link. You suggested
–
it's on the air. You may regret it now, but it certainly was what you suggested. And you managed to convince me of it, even though I don't remember how.
I said that it would affect the Stark Maesters as well. It would get rid of most of the Maesters, but not cripple some of the Maesters as long as both Threat stayed on and Lead Link stayed on.
Yeah.
But they put those other things on.
Yep, I agree. They did. So that's the next change. Both Threat and Valyrian Steel going on are a direct hit to the Maester's deck that was doing particularly well, but as well as every Maester deck was running Valyrian Steel Link. It was one of the primary reasons to play it.
Do you think that it was necessary to restrict a Link as well as the Threat?
When it comes to
Maesters, that's what I'm talking
about. Look at Stark or Rusted. Both were still extremely good Maester decks. And I think if you didn't restrict a Link as well, even the Baratheon Maesters would still exist. They just wouldn't use Threat. They'd use that attachment. They'd cycle the attachment that lets them burn people out, and you would have the same problem. So I think what they were saying, if they wanted to get rid of Maesters, this was the way of doing it.
When I mentioned it 2 weeks ago, my thought was mostly, yeah, they probably don't want to see the same Baron Maesters decks pop up at Worlds, or at least not the identical deck. And we've had a lot of luck out of Stark Maesters, and so I was trying to find a way that you could basically hit both without completely destroying them. And, you know, thinking, what I don't like, which is the wrong way to approach it. Things I don't like about the Stark Maesters deck, because I've never liked trait manipulation followed up by dissensions, but that wasn't a good restricted choice to put in there. And then John said, what about Valyrian Steel Link? And I said, oh, that's a great idea. And looking back on it, I think that Maesters can survive the loss of Valyrian Steel Link. They really can. But I don't think they will. I don't think they have the time to adapt within this space, because the agenda is still buying you a lot of room. It's still buying you a lot of toolbox, and it's not like you have less draw than any other deck because you don't have the Link. It was just it could just be icing on the cake. I don't think Maesters have the time to adapt to this, and I think the loss of Threat from the North gets rid of a lot of the combo potential that you could get card advantage from without having to necessarily draw cards through the Link.
Yeah, I think that was the problem. I think this FAQ came out way too late for the Maesters to actually respond to it with Valyrian Steel Link being here. If it had come out maybe a month ago, then it might be an okay FAQ with the Valyrian Steel link.
I think with both Threat from the North and Valyrian
Steel, it was too much already.
It wouldn't be recoverable.
Good anytime. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's also the third card that we haven't spoken about yet. Also hits pretty hard.
Super hard. Yeah, Harrenhal.
Yeah, Harrenhal, which is, I mean, it hits a lot of decks. We can talk about this a lot, but before we leave the Maesters, I think it's important to note that Harrenhal was very important in stopping the big effects or stopping whatever the Maesters are trying to do, build the Maester before you got all the chains off.
Cold hands, things like that.
Yeah. The No Quarter, everything
Seductive
like that.
Seductive Promise.
Yeah. I think hitting Maesters with three cards and one that's particularly just hitting Maesters is too much, I think. I agree with you, Alex. There are some points about the Maesters agenda and the Maester decks that we've seen for years that I don't like, and I know a lot of people don't like, but it's an agenda that a lot of people like as well. Brings new deck-building challenges. And I think it's important to have Maesters in the meta as well.
So the very last change, because they didn't touch the melee list at all, they didn't add any new rules for me to be excited about, is the change to Harrenhal. Now, we had discussed this again 2 weeks ago, and I'd sort of hoped it didn't happen in combination with some of the other things we suggested. Seeing it there, though, I'm actually pretty happy it is. For me, this is sort of like the Conclave last FAQ. This is the wild card. If it had just been the other changes, you'd basically say, take the meta, knock out these two types of decks, and then reassemble the meta.
Yeah.
And with Harrenhal off, you're reshuffling the entire meta. And so maybe we don't have time enough to adjust. Maybe it'll be a fairly unstable worlds where there'll be some unoptimized forms trying to exploit this opening. But Harrenhal going on opens up a lot of space and makes the deck building more exciting.
I don't know if it opens up a ton of deck building. I think it opens up 2-2-2.
I think it empowers a lot of Martell tricks, not just out of 2-2-2, but Savas and Gaston Grey both get considerably more powerful in the
back. And also,
He Calls It Thinking becomes way more powerful than before.
Okay, again, we're back with the Martell deck that was already really good. Like, Martell NA was good at Gen Con.
Okay, John, take this then. Greyjoy with cancels.
Yeah.
Has more value.
Yeah, considerably.
Yes, I agree. That I agree.
So you have loads of decks in Greyjoy that can bring lots of castles. You can play No Agenda. You can play 2B Kraken. You can play C6 now, which are you could before, but they're way more powerful now.
I'm betting you right now Steve Simone is at home drooling over this restricted list because it's going to let him play Martell Conquest of Greyjoy with the floating cancel and all the good Martell tricks and some of the boats from Greyjoy.
No, it doesn't help him play Barrow Black Sails. You're wrong. It's just
no. His second favorite deck is Martell Conquest of Greyjoy. I would be surprised if he is not tweaking that deck right now in anticipation of Worlds.
Now, what do you guys think that does to the lower end of the curve? So, for instance, lots of side considerations. We've taken away Threat from the North, but we've taken away Harrenhal. So your weenies are more likely to stick around, but they're less valuable as Harrenhal fuel. Venomous Blade winds up with fewer targets, more targets. What do you guys think about what that does to the lower end of the cost?
Don't think it changes it.
I don't think it does, and that it brings a lot of interesting ideas and interesting choices when it comes to cards to play. Because I think a card that First Snow of Winter is going to be really, really good. It was before, and it's still going to be really good. Because of the Martell and because of the Greyjoys.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
But one other thing that I thought about is when you take Harrenhal on the list, a lot of the cards that have been on the list for a long time become better again. For example, Narrow Escape.
Oh, yes.
For example, Orphan of the Greenblood.
Yep.
Like all of these cards that have an effect that can be cancelled, and it's a one-off, or in some cases, it's a three of in a deck, they become way more powerful again.
Like Birdie on the Sand.
Yeah, they become cards that are worthy of restriction again.
Things
if
like
you know
even
what I mean.
Arianne is similar.
Which I think may be healthy for the end of the game. I am not sure yet. Maybe it's a good thing that it happens so late so that people cannot develop these crazy, boring deck ideas again. I don't know.
you know, I'm not – you are going to Worlds, so yeah, we're not going to put the spotlight on you for this. But right now, where upon seeing this FAQ, the first thing that I thought I would look at, and this is probably because it's the last thing I played seriously, is that the Baronites that I was really pleased with but really knew that it's the thing that destroys it is Dragon Pit. I still played it at Gen Con. I think that although that deck loses Harrenhal, and I have to fix the Martell matchup a little bit because it's going to have some problems that Harrenhal used to compensate for, that's the first deck that I would consider revising right now to start putting as part of a gauntlet to start testing with. What about you guys? Do you guys have a deck that jumps out as you as something that you'd start? Even if it's not what you'd settle on or whatever, the first thing this list makes you think of looking at.
I have a couple that jump to mind. I mean, like I said, that Martell Conquest of Greyjoy jumped to mind right away because I feel that it has the cancel to deal with the 2-2-2 decks that are going to be running bleeds and these big board wipes. It has some saves to stop from Bungled Orders because I do expect some people to jump on the 2-2-2 bandwagon. And on top of that, it has all that Martell goodness. But as soon as I start thinking about Martell to Greyjoy, I kind of start thinking about that Noble deck that I built with you and John Bruno on the cast, Alex. And I think that it might kind of be something there too, and I'd have to play around with that. And finally, I think that These changes are going to make Martell NA and, well, different forms of Martell actually in general really powerful. Lannister is going to get strong. And we know the natural predator to that is Burn. I would try to find some kind of Burn as well.
Yeah, I think I would agree close to 100% with you, John. I was going to say earlier that when Dragon Pit and Threat hits the restricted list and so many other good Tar cards are on the restricted list, I'm not even sure there is a Tar deck. I'm sure there's a Tar deck out there, but there's nothing that comes to mind. It's like everything good is restricted and everything that needs a combo, both of the cards are restricted. Like, you can't run Daenerys into be a dragon. Like, what's the good counter to Lannister? Burn. And how can you run Burn? I'm not sure yet. I'm not sure if you can. But what's good to me is, like you said, John, Martell is in a very good spot, especially with Sivas coming off for the last FAQ. Lannister is in a good spot. The Iron Throne is going to be really powerful, I think. Greyjoy. My bet with some kind of Greyjoy with lots of cancels is going to be hard to stop.
Fair enough. All right. Well, we may not be happy with the way this has handled it, but do you think that it will guarantee that we see a different Worlds than we saw at Gen Con?
Yes.
Yes, definitely.
And do you think that Worlds and Stalak will be identical because something will emerge from it that is solved and unbeatable, basically?
No.
No.
So not the greatest FAQ, but not a problem.
I think it's fine. I think I would have liked them to handle it in another way. I think some of the changes were unnecessary, but it does one thing that I really like, and that it opens up the meta. It does.
All right. And my prediction is we're going to be talking about Martell and how great it is for basically the next 3 weeks. Everyone's going to expect a field full of Martell. And for no reason that anyone can tell,
there won't be a single Martell.
It happens every damn time.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we have a very special guest. We're going to call him Dave Dave. So he's a little bit better than the other Daves because he's got it twice in his name. And you were top four at
Worlds. So if I'm not mistaken, you were actually living in the U.S. for 6 months or for a year at the time. You got to attend a couple of tournaments in the States around the time of Worlds.
I've been working there during that time.
I heard you were at New York actually for a regional or something at one point.
Last regional that was sometimes this year. But I've actually not been working in New York, but I flew in from Chicago, where I've been during that time.
Awesome. All right. Well, Dave's here to talk to us about his pet topic. And what topic is that, Dave?
The tournament system. Because I just don't really understand why the current system is being used and why everybody seems to be okay with it. It's very flawed, in my opinion.
The tournament system in general is actually a really big topic because there's two large components of it. One of it is the individual tournament that you're playing, where right now FFG has like a Swiss style with a cut, and then the top 16 or 32 or whatever it is, playoff and single elimination. And then there's another component of it where it's about how you actually get to those events. So in Magic, they have like invitationals where you have to score a certain number of points at a lower level in order to be invited to a larger tournament that's more competitive. But in Thrones, you kind of just show up.
Yeah, I would say that for the purpose of keeping this discussion somewhat focused, let's focus on the first of those, the structure within a tournament rather than the meta structure. I'm not really looking at things like adding ELO ratings or grinders like that. Yeah. Not really different formats like driver versus deck. We're not looking at extending one-day events into 3 days or best-of-three matches, things that aren't completely going to change the way it works. And I think this format should probably be fairly stable, SCs, regionals, nationals, worlds, so that there isn't a completely different format for each stage.
So we're not going to talk at all about, you know, getting invited to other events due to your placement at a different event. We're just going to talk about the single event itself and how it's structured.
And maybe you guys disagree with it. The last sort of caveat I would put in place is that the purpose of a tournament is to crown a champion, that there should be a winner at the end of a tournament.
Oh, no, I agree with that.
Okay, so those will sort of be around.
Absolutely.
Well, John, how about you describe the current system first, and then we can have Dave poke all the holes he likes into it.
Sure. I mean, the current system for tournaments for Game of Thrones 1.0 and 2.0 is a Swiss-style event, which means basically that you're always playing someone that has similar win and loss record to you at each level. So as you progress through the Swiss, if you're winning, you're playing against better and better opponents in theory. Now, this is nice for newer players because they feel a lot of times that if they lose a few games, they will be playing people of similar skill level so that they will have a chance to win. And then after the Swiss, they take a top cut, which is determined by the number of players. Right, so what they do is they play Swiss until a single person, in theory, a single person has not lost any games. And once they get to that point, they take a subsection of the top cut, which can be 16, 32, or whatever, depending on the number of people there. I'm sure Alex has the exact math written down somewhere. Right, Alex?
No, and they don't follow their own math anyway, so it's mostly irrelevant.
Okay, true enough. They don't really follow that math. But if they did, then they take that subsection, and those people play single elimination, but they pair you based on your standing in the Swiss, so that the best Swiss standing is playing the worst Swiss standing that's in the cut. So, Dave, what do you think's wrong with this?
I personally really like the Swiss system, and it actually was something new when I was at the first tournament, because I've never played any competitive games before, actually. So I really liked that you got to play throughout the entire tournament. Eventually, I realized that it doesn't make that much of a difference if you lose two games in Swiss. The rest of the games are just going to be for fun. You're not going to make the cut.
Yep.
That's all fine. I still get my pairings, and I can, and I will certainly play on, but I do also understand people who drop at that point in time, because if it's about winning the tournament, you're out. That's the good part, essentially, to me about the Swiss, that you get to play, essentially, for most of the tournament. Now, what I do not like is, first of all, strength of schedule, because to there being a cut, only a certain amount of people are going to obviously make the cut. And this is not necessarily determined by solely by who won the most matches, but also by whom you played against. If your opponent has to leave early for whatever reason, then you just are screwed.
No. I do want to correct that somewhat, because the original strength of schedule system was simply adding the records, the points of all of your opponents. And that system, as you mentioned, if one of your opponents dropped out after losing two games or something, then your strength of schedule, having played him, was much, much weaker. The new system, however, normalizes it based on the number of games each person played and the number of total games you've played.
Okay.
So the strength of schedule system no longer punishes you for a drop, and it no longer punishes you for a bye in either direction. So the new calculation that they have for Tome and the new calculation that they have within the way they explain it for their tournament rules is certainly fair in that sense. Now, obviously, it's still luck dependent on who you face. If you face stronger players that won more of their games, you will have a stronger strength schedule.
That doesn't solve the problem of there being... I mean, I have the same number of losses and wins, than someone else and I'm not making the cut. So that's still there. Like if you have 8 people tournament and doing cut to top 4, you're going to have 1 undefeated player, 2 players with 1 loss, and then 3 players or something like that with 2 losses. So if you're going to have a strange cut here, I would have to do the math, really.
Okay, let's not worry about the math, but I think what the point is here is that strength of schedule in and of itself has a big flaw. And also the other trouble with this tournament is the fact that if you lose your first 2 games, you're just basically out of the running. So even if people that were 4-2, for instance, you went on to win all your other games, could continue to play, you'd be out. So from a tournament perspective, it would almost be better if there was one more round of Swiss to make sure that everyone that had like a 5-2 record in this example that I'm using would move on. So that if you lost your first 2 games, you would still have a chance to go undefeated for your other games and play. And I know this wouldn't remove the problem of people dropping. They would just drop one more round later. But we could look at alternative methods as well, right? Like, I've played in a couple tournaments that
Let's stick with this one first, because there's still some other criticisms to be leveled at it, and I'm not sure I really agree with either of your criticisms specifically. The idea that someone can eventually not make it, almost all of the systems have this unless you go with basically sort of random winning selection and things like that. But also,
most of the systems don't have this. It's only Swiss, right, that really feels the pain of having the same score and not moving on.
Okay, the Swiss with cut of having the same score and not moving on is true, except that you can't really structure that. What you say of adding an additional round doesn't work. You cannot actually structure Swiss in such a way that you know exactly how many people will have the second best record. Partly because of drops, partly because of the way mod wins and mod losses work, partly because of that. You can structure Swiss so that in theory there will only be at most one undefeated player, or play until you have only one undefeated player. That works fine. But you can't actually structure the number of Swiss rounds to make sure that everybody else up to a certain place has the same record. That's not possible.
Right.
So what you're suggesting doesn't quite work.
Well, I'm just saying that Swiss is flawed because of that.
Well, that's not really a problem with Swiss. That's a problem with Swiss with a cut.
Okay, I agree. Swiss with a cut.
Right. I think that the problem with Swiss to a cut is neither of those specifically. It's that depending on the size of your cut, you have players playing in the tournament to different goals. So, for instance, the person who finishes top of the Swiss and then is entering the cut is playing a single elimination tournament. The person who had one loss going into the Swiss is playing a double elimination tournament, and the person with 2 losses going into the Swiss is playing a triple elimination tournament. And I think that is a discrepancy that I'm not particularly fond of. I feel that because there's not enough reward placed on finishing top of the Swiss, and I think that it means that basically your performance throughout the day suddenly stops mattering, because really the first player playing the 32nd player is not at a significant advantage over the 16th playing the 17th, not within the way this field is structured. So I really do feel like once you've gone to the cut, you've essentially taken away some of the benefit that the players who have been performing better could potentially have. I feel like that's the greatest weakness of the Swiss to cut system.
That would have been my second point. So I fully agree.
I tasted that horrible, horrible winning all the Swiss and then losing the tournament taste. So I have to agree, Alex.
Hey, so did I. I had one loss in my Worlds tournament, and that's the one that stuck me in 5th place, while the eventual winner, Sam Bratz, who beat me, so fair enough, you know, it doesn't matter where he would have met me, he still would have beat me, but I think he went in with 2 losses, so he was playing a triple elimination tournament.
So you didn't get a backpack, did you?
I got a backpack from Melee.
Oh, okay. So
yeah, he was okay.
Your prizes.
Yes. He's got this overall thing, too. He's okay.
Yeah, I think I'm okay with overall.
That's
we don't
what's
like
wrong
this
with the current system. Yeah.
Yeah.
What would be a better system? Can we go to that?
Sure.
All right, because I've played in a couple other types of tournament settings, which I thought was interesting. I had a regional where it was double elimination, which was actually really fun, and some people lost and left early, and they were okay with that, and others had to wait sometimes for games, which was a little annoying. It worked good, but man, it would be really long with a large field. Like if you had 126 players, you'd be playing forever.
Double elimination only really works well if you got a power of two number of players, right?
Not quite.
No.
It does get a bit hairy. It's not necessarily brackets. So if you're doing double elimination, again, we're still talking Swiss, right? Where you're being paired against the strongest player.
Octagon tournaments.
Sure, like the Octagon. And you can extend that to a triple elimination because you have to once the field gets over. Well, it depends on the size of the field. That is a way of rewarding the players who are going undefeated because they may eventually, or they will eventually, wind up with a multiple repeat match against someone where they have a match in hand. Which sort of gives them that advantage. The multiple elimination format does have a drawback, and it's that it starts to get hairy near the top with pairings. You either get repeat pairings or players getting byes in unusual ways because of the way an uneven number of players are left, and certain people have played themselves played each other the previous round.
Are repeat pairings really a problem, though?
Well, obviously not the end, right? At the end, you only have two players. You know who your next match is going to be if you've got two games in hand.
The tournament I played in didn't allow repeat pairings until the end. So what happened was you had players playing, and then even though I had one loss, because I had the strongest strength of schedule versus the person that didn't have any losses, we both didn't play and had to wait for matches to finish before we would play our next game because we had already played each other.
Yeah, there certainly are some weird things like that that happen, and I'm not entirely clear of the best model for handing out buys at that point. So for instance, in the current model, a buy is handed out to the weakest player who hasn't yet received a buy. So you lost your first round and there's an uneven number of players, then, and you can get the buy, but you'll never get that buy again. Even if you're a weaker player.
Sorry, go ahead, Alex.
This format where you're starting to hand out buys near the top because of the way the pairings work out, it's a little harder to say, well, a buy is kind of an advantage, but can it go to... I don't know. It's not immediately obvious to me how the system should be structured as you get to the end.
Yeah, I think that's a harder one. The one that I found easier to manage and actually a lot more fun was a pod-based system where you'd actually play a round-robin game with everyone in your pod scoring points for your wins and losses, and then the two or three players with the highest strength of schedule from your pod would actually move on to another pod with the other players that scored similarly in their pods. So, for instance, if you had five pods, each with 10 players, they would all play. The top two players from each pod would come together to form another pod, and then you would play.
But round robin also can produce ties, right?
Correct. And ties are okay in a pod scenario where your pod moves on until you get to the Swiss.
Yeah. So you would still need someone to determine who moves to which pod.
If there was a three-way time, for instance, yes.
Tie.
Yeah.
So what you're describing is very, very common in sports in general. In the National Hockey League, they're basically playing within divisions, and those are selected for the playoff rounds. Lots of American sports with bad names for whether they're American or World Series or whatever also follow a similar thing where you're playing most of your games within your smaller group and then one or two people are picked out of that. The World Cup in football as well works within a similar system. You're broken up into little groups. You play everyone in that group once or twice depending on the system, and then one or two of you graduate on to an elimination format. So that's roughly what you're describing?
Yeah. Very similar. So,
and you're saying that, just to be entirely clear, so we have a group of eight, one and two will move on from the other four groups, and they'll all be in a new group of eight.
Yeah.
That's a lot of games for a tournament of that size. The other thing is, so what's happening to three and four? They're done?
They're done.
Okay. Just to be clear on the system.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the people in the pod that don't move on, they're done for the day. So, and the pods, the one that I played was like pod of six. So you played six games and you moved on and you played another six games, which is 12 games, which is a ton of games.
And that's for 36 players.
Yes. But you can.
Or no, I guess it could be for 18.
Yeah. Okay, well, you could. You can. This is the nice thing about it. You can change it from 18 to 36 to whatever. It depends how many people you choose to move on from each pod and the size of the pod. A pod could be four players with only the top one moving on, right? Or the pod could be six players with the top one moving on, or 10 players with the top two moving on. And you could also, you don't have to necessarily play round robin in a pod. You can do a Swiss standing in a pod where the top two of Swiss move on, or other types of games to limit the number of games so that you're not playing 40 games over 2 days or something.
One problem I see with that system is, how do you determine who is in which pod?
It's randomly determined to start. Yeah.
So you can have
a bunch of strong players or weak. Yeah. In theory, you can have a really killer pod, and then the top two from that pod are really strong, and when they go, they'll crush the other people. And it's not like they didn't play the best players. They would have had to, you know, make it through their pod, that really killer pod. And I agree that someone could move on that maybe wasn't as strong as the people in that killer pod, but the chance of them winning the overall tournament is pretty low, thanks to the fact that they still have to play the best of breed from that first pod, that super pod.
Yeah, there's one major advantage to that and a whole bunch of drawbacks as I see it. And the major advantage is that it functionally allows you to have basically the same tournament structure in Melee, in Joust, and in Draft. Because Drafts have to work in pods anyway.
Yep.
Because otherwise they get unwieldy. Melee, functionally, whatever your table size is a pod. So you can kind of break that down to the same system, so you get that sort of uniformity. However, to me, if what you're doing is Swiss pairing within a pod, then you're functionally working no different from Swiss overall, and then you're taking a cut, except you're taking a top two. We have the same strength of schedule issues we had before. We have the same not rewarding, you know, one person finishes undefeated and the other person has a loss and gets through. To me, I see no advantages to that structure
unless
over the
you
Swiss
actually,
with the cut.
I agree. Sorry, go ahead.
You're going to say unless you do round robin.
Unless you introduce a non-Swiss style within the pod.
Round robin doesn't solve it, though.
I don't think round robin solves it either, but you can use other forms of tournament within a pod the same way you could in a larger event. So any solution that you could think of for a bigger, you know, bubble would work in the pod.
Yeah, I believe Stalik 1 year decided to break things down into pods, and instead of seeding the cut from the top 32 overall, they took the top four from each pod, or the top eight from each pod. I don't exactly know how many players they had that year. But that functionally amounted to, aside from the fact that you could be in a slightly easier or slightly harder pod, amounted to absolutely no different from straight Swiss into a cut, like we already do. It was just simplifying the logistics of the tournament by keeping people to the same part of the tournament hall, by allowing them, the TOs, to organize this slightly smaller 60-person event instead of a 200-person event. So it had some organizational advantages, but I don't think it has any structural advantages.
So we've been talking about the events that I've actually participated in. I've participated in both the double elimination and the pod. Have you guys played any alternate formats?
I've played in True Swiss without a cut.
Okay.
The advantage to that is we already know the structure. We know how the pairing works. In theory, you're always playing against someone else. And obviously, you're rewarded for being undefeated.
But that's
drawback,
really single
the drawback,
elimination.
Of course, is that it's functionally single elimination if the purpose is only to win. You're playing a single elimination tournament. I agree.
I've played at the Slot Championship where we played round robin completely because it was rather small. And we were very lucky that the last game ended the way it did, because otherwise we would have had a three-way tie. So that's why I'm totally not convinced of round robin anymore.
Okay, so within a round robin system, so a round robin system is where you play every other player a certain number of times, typically once.
Yeah, every player once, normally.
Normally, the first tiebreaker is your records against each other. So it's really hard to get a three-way tie.
You just kind of have to defeat each other in a circle.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it certainly can happen, but it's kind of an awkward system. So you need to have the same number of wins each and the same number of losses each, and within those people with the same number of wins and losses have to have the same number of wins and losses against each other.
Yes.
That's tricky.
That apart from one game. So that
wow.
Cider.
Well, I suppose that is a problem with the system. I don't know how regular that is. I have played round robin tournaments.
Awesome.
I think we had a 5 or 6 man store championship here that the people from Montreal came up to, and we played that round robin. Everybody got to play. And within that small system, it's nice because as soon as you finish a round, you wait till someone else frees up and you go do that. You don't need to wait for pairings and things like that. But you're right that you can result in rather odd ties. Although presumably, you could introduce a tiebreaker there that would not be random. by allowing a rematch.
For example, okay, rematches, yeah. That would be another idea, actually, but probably not feasible due to time constraints. Having all matches essentially be best of threes.
This is what's done in Magic, and I don't think it changes the tournament structure at all. You're still basically working through Swiss pairings or working through a cut. That doesn't change. The fact that you have best of three matches in Magic still have rounds that are about an hour, while in Thrones that would be rounds that are about 3 hours. There is another tournament structure that has been used in Thrones. They work for slightly different events. They are adaptable. So one of them is to have a winner's bracket and a loser's bracket. It's functionally a double elimination tournament, but the way the brackets play out, we've seen this for the European Team Championship. I don't know if you guys followed those. Again, has most of the same properties as a double elimination, and again can end up with the team that has gone undefeated losing to the team that has lost once. I don't think you wind up with a game in hand the way that pairing works, but maybe you do. I don't actually know.
All right, so we've talked about what we've played in. We've talked about the current system, but we haven't talked about what we would like to see implemented. And
One more.
Alex always has something to say, Dave.
I always have something more. I mentioned team events, but there are other ways of handling team events, like by faction. So all the players playing Targ are playing as a team, or by meta, all the players from DC are playing as a team. And you can
break things. Well, they already do that, right?
Details. But there are ways that you can structure tournaments so that a team emerges the winner rather than a player. And then you could be the highest ranked player in your team. That's fine, too.
Well, I was saying that we talked about, you know, the tournaments we played in, the current thing, but we haven't talked about a solution. We've mentioned that there's all these problems with these different types of events. So, Dave, you wanted to talk to us. What do you think the solution would be?
The way I would prefer tournaments to be run is actually the Octagon tournament way, where we have that kind of Swiss pairings with double elimination. I agree that there's the problem with the buy, but usually it would be more work to figure out how to do that. But you can most of the time have it so that each player has one bye before he's eliminated, which evens things out completely. At latest, when there are only three players left, which will eventually happen, you can give byes to people who haven't gotten one and who would otherwise be eliminated. And so there are instances where player would be eliminated without ever having a bye, but I guess that's the downside then we have there. But all in all, it seems to mitigate the luck factor in the current system, which is my problem with it. Because, as you mentioned, being undefeated in Swiss and then losing one match, why is that match suddenly more important than the one that all the prior matches? So that's what I dislike. Also strength of schedule, and both of those are no problem in that system.
And how is that match more difficult to play than, you know, your seventh match of the Swiss?
I also want to mention that one of the advantages is completely independent of the tournament structure, but for people watching it, of both this and systems with a cut and so on, is that there is a final match that determines the winner. While in a true Swiss, you don't always have a single final match that determines the winner.
In a true Swiss, you do.
To have.
Then you had too many rounds planned.
No. The number of rounds you play is the amount that guarantees no more than one undefeated. But sometimes you can wind up with no undefeated.
Okay.
Depending on how early pairings went, buys went, and other systems were integrated into it. You can wind up with a system where you will never wind up with
like
more
one
than
round
one.
Early.
So in here, you always have a final match, sometimes two or three final matches, because one person's playing single elim and the other person's playing triple elim in that final set. But people can watch that and know that the championship is riding on these matches, which can be quite entertaining and can be an additional factor that we hadn't actually mentioned in some of these other ones, like round robin formats, where who won could have been determined 3 rounds ago.
I actually played in the Octagon tournament that was double elimination. I didn't get to play most of my games because of scheduling conflicts, but I had fun in the ones I did, and I thought it was very well balanced, so I'd love to see that actually adopted by FFG.
We mentioned that there is one drawback to this double or triple or single elimination, depending on what size of field and how you want to run it, and that is that players can have as few as two games. Now, obviously, if your only goal was to win, In a true Swiss, you could have dropped out after your two losses anyway. But if you want to reward people for playing, for the number of matches they get, if you want to give them points for that kind of thing, for prize support, there is that drawback to the double elimination system, well, in which it doesn't really encourage people playing, even if they're losing.
You can continue doing pairings for those. It's the same thing. They aren't going to win the tournament.
I actually think that double elimination followed by a loser bracket after the fourth round or something would be awesome, where everyone that kind of fell out can do the last chance tournament. They do this in poker a lot, where you play for the first 3 hours, and then all those people that have been knocked out can join the next tournament that's actually going on. It has a smaller prize and reputable. It's not as great winning it, but it's still another tournament. It's still a chance to win, and you get to go and join that tournament and play it if you get knocked out within the first 3 hours.
So is that not unfairly punishing the people who get knocked out after 3 hours and 5 minutes?
Why are they punished? Because they can't play in the other tournament? That's a punishment now?
Well, no, but I mean,
it's just another tournament that's happening at a certain time that's set enough so that people that only, so you know, got knocked out early. Yeah.
Basically.
It's smaller, and it lets you finish on time as well, right? Maybe you could cut it down by a round. It's limited in the number of players, but the players that get knocked out early have something to do, and they can play, and then they can watch the final, and it might be a single elimination Swiss or something smaller on the side. They also do single table tournaments in poker, and you can do the same thing in basically any game. You can have startups that go every couple hours, and they do this in Magic, where 8 players get together and they play a single elimination 8-player mini tournament for a small prize.
I don't really understand why all of that is necessary in the first place. Because if I'm going to a tournament and lost the first 2 rounds, and if you're doing that Swiss rounds of double elimination kind of tournament, then I'm just gonna go around and look for someone else who already is out of the tournament and play with them. I don't really see the point of having that pairing told. I don't need someone to tell me to play someone.
Well, I think it encourages you playing people that you might not have played otherwise. It also encourages you to play within a tournament structure so that maybe you're still going to play it like a tournament match, learn more from it, because it sort of knocks you into that philosophy. I actually prefer what you were suggesting earlier, which is to continue to do Swiss pairings the whole way through, but simply knock you out of qualification for the championship after 2 losses. So play double elimination for the championship, yeah, but continue to do Swiss pairings for everyone.
So how would you handle buys then? The players who are still in there, would you give buys to them or let them play against players who actually already have too many losses?
I would still give them buys, I think.
Because I think that actually would be maybe an alternative to the buy problem, because you just let them play against the top player from the already defeated ones, and then he has to fight for his buy, essentially.
He does. I worry that there may be a situation in which the person who is now out of the running but still playing because it's the tournament has less of an incentive to win.
Then give prizes for every player who gets kicked out.
So for every person you eliminate?
Yes.
Oh, they do that in poker too, like knockout events. Every person you knock out gives you a little something. In poker, it's usually a cash reward, like $5 for every player you knock out. So you could get points, and the points can be used like the old Golden Dragon award type thing.
That's not necessarily a bad idea either, then, to avoid the buy, as you said, is to say that once you basically dropped through past the elimination threshold, if you continue to play, and this is an incentive to continue to play, you might be the top paired within the people who are eliminated, get paired against someone from the other bracket, and have a chance to win one of the knockout prizes. And that's not necessarily a bad way of doing it. I could see that being implemented. I like it. I think it probably could be implemented. I know we've been doing something similar in the Octagon tournaments, and it so far seems to have worked. There, I don't think there's as much of an incentive to keep people into the tournament, because people didn't travel for it, for instance.
Yeah.
Right? Well, if someone shows up to the store championship, I am on the side that says, even if they've lost their 2 games, I think we should encourage them to continue to play through the tournament and get that tournament experience.
So they didn't drive for 3 hours to only play for 2.
Right, or just to play pickup games afterwards, which is something they could have done otherwise. To still feel like they're a part of this tournament. And I think a way to incentivize that is to allow You know, the chance that you might rise to that knockout stage where you get to knock someone out and get some reward for that. So that's not that bad either. I think that could be fun.
Yeah, it was my idea after all. I like it too.
Yeah, good. Good
idea. You like your own idea? Wow.
I particularly like the fact that you proposed a solution to the fact that it's essentially just a double elimination tournament you walk away by saying, continue to do the Swiss pairings. There's no reason you can't. And you're right.
Yeah, that's actually the conclusion I came to myself. So just let's run octagon-style tournaments from now on. That's also the official name for that kind of tournament now.
Ooh, I don't know if I want to give Octagon a name to anything. No. If anything, we'll call it a Dave tournament.
No, it was my idea. I know Lauren is organizing those tournaments now. Who was it before?
It was
a D tournament. A double D tournament.
Double D.
That's breast size, or?
Yes, that would be breast size.
You guys are so dirty-minded. I was just, you know, stating a fact because it's from Dave. Double Ds.
Yeah, I can live with that.
So you're telling me if it's a, you know, 36-person tournament, it's a 36DD?
Yep. So today, our tip of the week for new players is something that's going to sound a little strange, but once you play a game against an opponent, hopefully a friendly one, switch decks and play your opponent's deck while he or she plays yours. This will give you an excellent view of a bunch of different decks, but it will also let you see the difference player skill and deck building makes, because as you play another deck, you start to see how that other person approached deck building, and maybe they're going to give you some hints or some interactions you weren't used to. And on top of that, you're going to see from the other side of the table how your deck performs and where its weaknesses and strengths are. Because normally, those weaknesses and strengths can hide themselves a little bit from a person when they're playing the deck itself. But when you're playing against it, you're trying to figure out ways to exploit its weaknesses, and they become more apparent.
I would say this also has a secondary advantage. And this is that you get to experience more decks that people have refined without having to do the entire process yourself. So essentially, you've played a good match against someone and then try and play with their deck. Even if you don't learn all that much about your deck or theirs, you'll have had a chance to play a well-built deck handed to you. You won't have had to sleeve it. It'll give you more experience with different decks, and that's always a good thing to have. So don't hesitate. You beat someone, you lost, ask for the rematch where you guys swap decks. Most people will be happy to. So people accuse us of not having enough Europeans on the cast, so this week we managed to get three of them. This is our third. We haven't heard your dulcet tones, Raoul, in a while, but you just won a second place in a 2.0 championship. So second place in a second edition tournament must mean it's like first place in a first edition, right?
Well, almost.
So Raoul's joining us for this very quick segment where we have been given the opportunity to spoil cards from second edition from the very first chapter pack. So Raoul, would you care to start us off with the first card?
Yeah, sure. The first card is Allocation, a neutral one. And it's Street of Sisters. It has King's Landing straight, reaction, after you win a power challenge by 5 or more strength, need your faction card to gain 1 power for your faction.
And all that for 1 gold.
Yeah.
So, any thoughts?
If they are going to put more effects about kneeling your house card, then Filthy is going to be a problem.
Well, that's my first thought, is the faction kneeling. I mean, obviously the closest comparison is Superior Claim, which is that zero cost event that gives you 2 power for a very, very similar condition. But here
that's not the most similar. The most similar is actually the attachment where you pay 2 gold and get 2 power.
What attachment is that?
Attachment?
Yeah, it's an attachment because it's repeatable, just like this card.
What attachment gives you 2 power?
It's from Vera.
Yeah.
There's no attachment in Vera that gives you 2 power.
There is. Let me find it.
Lightbringer gives you the ability to stand your character after they claim power for renown.
We're talking about in 1.0, right?
No, we're talking about 2.0.
You said it was most like a 1.0 card. So.
No, I said it was like Superior Claim in 2nd edition, which is a zero-cost event that triggers off of 5 or more. And
no one cares about your 2nd edition. Let's focus on 1.0. And in 1.0, there's an attachment for two that lets you gain two power, which is the same damn thing. So it's probably balanced.
I'm mostly interested in the faction card kneeling. This is obviously a fairly good effect. It's not stellar. It's not going to win you the game, but it's going to be worth playing in a rush deck. Probably going to get you two or three power over the course of the game for a fairly low cost. But that kneeling your faction card, I'm really glad to see it on repeatable costs like this, because we just saw Seastone Chair spoiled on the Quillen Tankard's regular. So this is another card that's competing for that space, that's making you say, if you use one, you can't use the other.
You know, it's something they didn't do very well in 1.0, was that limited response, really, outside of a few very specific houses, didn't have a big cost. But we are seeing that kneeling the faction card, which I feel is basically the new limited response, really does. There's actually some competing cards, which is nice, because you can play those cards and you just have to make that choice every round.
Yeah, it can become both a deck-building decision and a play decision, right? You can say, I have too many Neil Faction card ones, or you could, you know, have them in hand and go, which one do I want to use this turn? And I think what's important for that is that some of them have to be repeatable, because if they're just all one-shot things, then they're less likely to coincide, and it's just a question of how many do you include in your deck so you're not often...
Right, no conflict. Exactly. Yeah.
But if you have Street of Sisters out and you're playing Fealty, maybe you've made a deck-building mistake, I don't know, but it's possible
that you're
going, this turn I need the reduction, so Street of Sisters is not worth it, but you know, maybe another turn I want to use the Seastone Chair, and therefore I can't use Fealty or the Street of Sisters. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. But I think that these effects about kneeling your faction, they're going to be huge. As far as we have seen, because the system chair is amazing.
Oh, policia. No, ambulancia?
Yeah.
All right. Well, the cops are about to take out Raul, so we'll have to go through the second card. Before getting Raul to read it out, I will say, of all the cards we've seen in the next cycle, I can already tell you this is my favorite, and it's probably going to be my favorite card of the whole cycle. I'm super excited about this card. So,
seems very powerful as well.
Yeah, it's a neutral one-cost event. It's called Support of the People. Reaction, after you win a power challenge by 5 or more strength, the game, set your deck for a location with printed cost 3 or lower and put it into play. Shuffle your deck max 1 per challenge. Wow.
Super huge. All those draw locations are in that 3 hot spot, you know, and as well as Targaryen's burn location. This is going to be a big card.
There are two things that I really, really like about it. The first is these two cards together seem to sort of help build power as the constructive challenge, the one that's helping you build up your board position. It's helping you build up your, you know, with the Red Keep, it's helping you build up your cards, your board position. It's not like Intrigue where you play tiers of lists. It's not like... I mean, generally speaking, it's the more constructive rather than destructive form. But what I really like about this is how strongly it values power challenges, even in the early game.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I'm afraid this is going to be seen in all Baratheon decks.
For the early on, this may be seen in almost all decks that can reliably win a power
challenge. Yeah,
It's an amazingly powerful card. But the thing is that it means that on turn one, not only are you more worried about military than any other turn, generally, because you have fewer characters and you're losing a higher value character, and you might be a little more, maybe a little less worried about intrigue depending on your reserve, but generally on turn one, people go, power challenge, I'll just leave it unopposed if I'm
unopposed. Yeah.
And here you're going, oh, he's power challenging me for 5.
Maybe I have to chump block. Yeah, maybe just this one strength guy here has got to get involved.
And to me, that makes a huge difference. Like, I've loved what Prize did for first edition for valuing power challenges, especially earlier in the game.
Early game, yep.
And I think this is a card that does exactly that. It makes power challenges extremely valuable in the early game.
This did for power challenge what Tears of List did for entry challenges, making them valuable right from the get-go.
Yeah.
And that's great. Mm-hmm.
And I guess the biggest disappointment will be that it probably means I'm going to wind up buying 2 of this chapter pack to be able to have 2 decks built at a time. I don't know. May well.
Because you're going to have 3 Support of the People in each.
even just from an economy standpoint, people are saying, the economy is kind of constrained in this game. You can put in a limited location with this.
Yeah, you can cheat limited in.
So that's not necessarily the very best use of the gold that you have, but it can help you with that limited
card. Yeah, but if you're struggling next turn for economy, this is really nice.
However, the one drawback is it says cost 3 or lower, so it's still a big I can't say that on the cast. It's still flipping the bird to the Night's Watch.
Yeah, no wall for you.
No wall for you.
Why don't they have reducers, for God's sake?
What did the Night Watch search? If it was pure Night's Watch, what could they search?
Oh, this? Castle Black is great. Castle Black is great.
Yeah, Castle Black.
Yeah, Castle Black. Then the neutral gold locations, I mean.
Super excited about this card. I don't think I'm exaggerating in saying this may be the best card of the cycle, not having seen the cycle. This is phenomenal for the game. Can you think of a deck it doesn't go in?
Right now, no, because I haven't played a lot.
Yeah, not off the top of my head.
Not off the top of your head. Well, I think it'll be hard for Fealties to get it in there, or they'll be squeezing something else out, because it's an additional neutral card.
Well, yeah.
Just somewhat, sure. Some people might lose the Fealty agenda for this card.
Yeah, it's just that good. Oh, man, I'm excited about it. In the first chapter fact, too. This is going to completely change the game. It's great.
Which is nice, because that means, hopefully, this chapter pack will be at Worlds, right?
I suspect it will be.
And it'll be legal.
It would be legal. Yeah.
So that'd be great.
Closing comments, John. What do you got for me for closing comments?
Nothing.
That's weeks in a row now. You're failing me.
I'm so sorry.
You can tell people about how you're not going to be here next week.
I'm going to Vegas, and I'm not going to be here next week. I'm sorry.
We will still have a cast. I've got a couple of people lined up. I'm sure we'll think of something. But obviously, you know, it won't be the same without you, John.
Aw, thanks, Alex. You're the best.
Aside from that, I was asked to promote a couple of tournaments. So there's Roy from New York, who was mentioning their Game of Thrones 2nd Edition launch tournament, which is going to be on Saturday, October 31st. Yes, Halloween. I think there's even prizes for costumes and the like. There's more information found on the New York Facebook page. Registration will be at 10, play at 10:30. It's at the Uncommons on 230 Thompson Street in New York. So this is their inaugural tournament. It's also sort of a warm-up for their big Red Saturday event coming in November, and so they're hoping to get a lot of people in for this inaugural tournament. I have one that I probably don't need to promote on the cast because I don't think anyone yet is listening that will be coming to it, but I have my inaugural Thrones Night this Thursday, my very first meeting of my very first meta ever. I'm excited.
Excellent.
It's at La Boutique L'Imaginaire at Place Laurier in Quebec, so if for some reason you're listening and you don't know about it, show up from 5:30 to 9. That's in the store that's carrying most of the cores in Quebec City. I'll be bringing demo decks. I'll be bringing decks for people if they want to play competitively. You don't need to know the game. You don't need to know the rules. Just show up. I want people. That's all I need. And then finally, the Chilean meta reached out to let us know that their opening tournament will be on November 7th. And finally, by the time people are listening to this, Canada will have a government that isn't conservative, right?
I hope to God Alex is right.
Otherwise, we'll just... if the conservatives get reelected, podcasts become illegal. So
basically, we can't podcast anymore.
Yeah, so you guys all have to pray that the Liberal or NDP or Green parties win.
Just anyone.
Anyone but the conservatives. So hopefully we can get you all behind that.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.